Hello there, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the TCE podcast for March 2015. I am your host, Richard Janssen Parks. Today, I am joined by senior reporter Helen Tunnicliffe.
Hello.
Today, we're going to be talking about the victory of a chemical engineer at the Queen Elizabeth Prize for Engineering, how industry is uniting behind CCS, how a new piece of kit will make it cheaper and safer to produce a cyanide for a mining, and we'll have a front lines a report from Frank Morton 2015, as well as all of the latest news in the world of a chemical and process engineering. Our lead news story this month concerns Robert Erlanger and his victory. His success. At the Queen, what's it called? The Queen Elizabeth Prize for Engineering, which won him, I mean, it's sort of been set up as the missing a Nobel Prize for Engineering sort of thing. It's worth £1 million, so about $1.5 million. And it's quite a
prestigious thing. That's a pretty good amount of money.
Yeah.
I could go for that.
I wouldn't turn it down. A chemical engineer from MIT, Robert Erlanger, sort of won the prize for his work on the controlled release of large molecule drugs. But he's a really well-known figure in the world of chemical engineering research. I know that quite a few of the stories that pass our desk that come from MIT feature his presence, you know, at least somewhere in there.
Yeah, we've written about Robert Erlanger a lot and all the things that he's done. So, but specifically, his work on controlled release drugs has benefited, they reckon, millions, possibly billions of people suffering from diseases including brain cancer, diabetes, schizophrenia. He started out with these large molecules, which everybody thought couldn't be used as drugs. They had great therapeutic possibilities, but as they pass through the body, they break down. But Robert Erlanger, with his brilliant chemical engineering knowledge, developed polymers to shield the molecules, so they could be used as drugs, and it really has changed a lot of people's lives, so it's fantastic.
But his victory wasn't without a little bit of controversy, at least for us at TCE and at iChemie as a whole, or was it though?
Yes, something that irritated me. Some of you may have seen me tweeting about this. There was quite a lot of media outlets in the UK and internationally that refused to describe Robert Erlanger as a chemical engineer. What really got our backs up to start with was the BBC, the British Broadcasting Corporation, describing him as a drugs pioneer.
They completely excised any mention of a chemical engineering or even engineering as a whole from his job. It seemed crazy, especially as it was, you know, the Queen Elizabeth Prize for Engineering meant to sort of recognise this branch of stuff that doesn't really get the big attention that the pure sciences do in the Nobels.
It's pretty frustrating. We also just saw him described as a biomedical engineer, a chemist, all sorts of things like that. Drug delivery engineer. He's a chemical engineer. He describes himself as a chemical engineer. It really shouldn't be that hard.
Adam managed to grab an interview with Professor Erlanger. So if you want to hear how he thinks of himself, then you can have a listen to that now.
Okay, well, first off, congratulations on winning the prize. Obviously, we've discussed quite a lot today about the background of the technology itself. I wanted to delve a little bit more into your chemical engineering background. So perhaps you could just share with me your thoughts about how has your chemical engineering education shaped your research choices and the achievements that have followed?
Well, I think it's had a fundamental impact. I mean, almost everything I do has been applying my chemical engineering background to medicine. So, I mean, I could give examples, but it's really been, that's the heart of what we do. I sort of have seen different medical problems and use chemical engineering to create new materials, understand how to deliver materials and, you know, different things like that.
Is there anything particularly unique about the chemical engineering discipline itself that's helped you achieve your success?
Well, I guess a couple things. One is, I think, the problem-solving nature of it. Two are the courses. But three, and maybe an example might be helpful. And part of it was me being, and I'll give you the example in a second, me being a chemical engineer and then seeing what goes on in the medical field. But, you know, when I was at the hospital, for example, one of the things I noticed was that a lot of the materials that were used in medicine were things that doctors were the driving force for. And, you know, and so just to give you an example, the material in the artificial heart's a lady's girdle material because it had a good flex life.
Okay.
The material in a breast implant is a mattress stuffing because it's squishy. And that's sort of what was done. But the way I started thinking about it, you know, those create problems, right? I mean, artificial heart can cause clots and cause strokes because it's not a natural material to be in contact with blood. And you know, and to give some other examples, well, I could go on and on. But what we started doing was take sort of, I thought, well, why don't I just take a chemical engineering design approach and ask the question, what do we really want in a biomaterial from an engineering standpoint, chemistry standpoint, and biology standpoint, and then design them from first principles. And that led to new kinds of materials that could, say, dissolve in certain predictable ways. That actually would lead to a new system, the Gliadin wafer, that we were involved in developing to treat brain cancer, which has been used in over 30 countries for over 19 years.
Excellent. No, that's a brilliant answer. Thank you very much. Given your experiences and success, what advice would you give to chemical engineers that are starting out today?
Well, I think what advice I'd give them, I'd say, you know, I still feel an undergraduate chemical engineer should learn fundamentals, and because that really is going to be key. I think as you go to graduate school, it's a little bit different. That, you know, I think learning how to do research is really important, and trying to figure out what are really important questions that you can answer. You know, and I guess my feeling is the following, that, you know, when you're an undergraduate, and even to a certain extent when you're a student, you know, you're judged on how, you know, good your answers are. But in life, you're really judged on how good your questions are, right? If you do a good job of answering unimportant questions, I don't think it gets you very far. So, so basically, you know, that's kind of how I view it. That you know, you want to learn fundamentals, but you want to learn what important problems are and how to and get a really good education.
Excellent. Obviously, there are some vast challenges that engineers can actually make a huge difference to today. If you were a fresh-faced chemical engineering graduate, what area of research would you throw yourself into today?
Well, I believe in the bio. I mean, personally, I'm prejudiced, but I think the bio area is just incredibly exciting. I think nanotechnology is also exciting. But, you know, those are a couple ones that I think about. That those two areas, and I'm very excited about chemical engineering, obviously, but chemical engineering is a very broad discipline, Flynn, and you can do a lot of different things in it.
Okay. There's been some consternation at the Institution of Chemical Engineers. They were a little bit put off by the fact that the BBC, in its coverage of you winning the prize, has described you as a drug delivery engineer. How would you describe yourself?
A chemical engineer or a bioengineer?
Okay.
Or both, but I'm definitely a chemical engineer. I mean, drug delivery, I think, is narrower. I mean, I think they're partly right, no offense to the BBC, but I think that, you know, that's one aspect of what we do.
Okay. I guess the final question is, I spend a lot of time speaking to chemical engineers who work in industry, and they find that their job titles are tweaked to remove the word chemical from their business cards. Especially in areas perhaps like in food science or in the pharma sector as well, where chemical can become a bit of a pejorative word. In your experience in the world of research, do you find there's any stigma attached to the term chemical engineer?
I have not seen it. You know, I mean, you might be in a better position to judge than I, but, you know, but I have not seen it. What do you think? I don't know.
Well, I've certainly seen it in the world of industry, but we were just interested to see whether you'd seen it from your position, perhaps, you know, working across boundaries with lots of other disciplines, whether perhaps there's maybe not a stigma, but surprise that someone from the world of with a chemical engineering background is kind of working in the fields of medicine. Is there any surprise that
well, I think
that
that's
background?
Interesting. I think initially when engineers first started working in medicine, I think it wasn't necessarily so well accepted either. I mean, it was, you know, I think today it's much more accepted.
Okay, I guess the message is that chemical engineers should just go out there and keep breaking down boundaries then.
Well, I believe in that. Whether it's chemical engineers or anybody, I believe in that. But I think that's right. I think chemical engineers are actually a great training to do just that.
Our next story this month comes from the U.S. our government, who says that it is planning to more than a double the amount it's spending to combat the threat of antibiotic resistance, pledging $1.2 billion in its latest budget to go on a whole range of projects to help combat this pretty huge threat. I think that last year was described by the World Health Organization as sort of one of the biggest threats to humanity as a whole.
Well, yes, of course. I mean, at the start of the 20th century, there were lots of diseases and illnesses that are completely incurable, and then penicillin came along and suddenly lots of things that people that were killing people before, people were recovering from. And now we've forgotten the horrors of some of these diseases like TB, like syphilis and things like that, which you just don't really see anymore. Or do you? Increasingly they are becoming resistant. Increasingly you are seeing infections like MRSA and other sort of superbugs like that taking over hospitals and closing wards and killing people.
I mean, that's one thing. So obviously most of the funding is going on sort of the towards a research and new antibiotics and that sort of thing. But quite a lot of the money, $77 million of it, in fact, is going specifically to the Department of Agriculture to help stop the overuse of antibiotics on farms, because that's apparently a huge thing of just sort of preemptively treating animals with antibiotics to stop them getting sick in the first place rather than using them when they are sick. And then obviously that builds up huge amounts of resistance really, really quickly.
Yeah, it's a pretty terrible thing. They just pump them full of antibiotics whether they need it or not. Well, you might get something nasty, so here's some antibiotics. And then, of course, all the bacteria just get resistant. It is becoming a big problem.
And of course, it's worth bearing in mind that this isn't a sort of a problem for the future. It's a problem right now. As part of all of this, the White House said that the CDC, which is the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, estimates that around 2 million illnesses and 23,000 deaths per year can be attributed to antibiotic-resistant bacteria in the US alone, which is a pretty incredible sum.
It's huge, yeah. Definitely good to try and get some money behind the research for that.
Have you seen the BP Process Safety Series book collection that we offer? Produced in collaboration with BP, the series aims to help the reader understand safe operating practices and procedures within process plants. They are also now available as e-books for you to read on the go. Visit www.ichemie.org/shop to view the collection or email sales@ichemie.org.
One of our top features this month comes from Australia's Asinogen, which won the Outstanding Achievement Award from iChemie in 2014 for its work on producing a cyanide at mining sites. Earlier this week, I spoke to Managing Director Chris Dunk about the company's work and what it hopes to achieve.
What are the issues out there with a traditional cyanide production processes, especially when it comes to producing it from mines?
But it's actually not necessarily anything wrong with the process of production. It's actually the way that it's handled or used on the process it's taken to get it from traditional manufacturing to site, and then the way that it's having to be handled on site. That's really what we're addressing. Traditional process of making cyanide has been known for many, many years and works very, very well. There's a number of different ways you can manufacture cyanide. And they're all effective, they're cost effective, and the companies that run them very safely. What we're addressing is the inherent risks that are associated with the transportation of cyanide from traditional manufacturing locations to mine sites. And many of those mine sites are very remote, or to get to them you go through ecologically sensitive areas or communities that are very sensitive to having toxic chemicals being transported through their community. And then once it arrives on site, there's various things that need to be done with that cyanide to get it into a form that's then used in the gold, silver or base metals operation. And some of those mine sites, they receive a pellet, a solid pellet of cyanide, and they have to dilute it. And that's a process which requires manual handling and exposure to potentially toxic gases and liquids. And there are other ways which are safer, but really what we're addressing is that transportation of cyanide and the handling at site through our technology, which makes it on-site, doesn't expose anybody to any of the chemicals. We make a dilute solution, which is exactly what the site requires, and then we pump it straight into the cyanide holding tank on site, ready for the site to use. So there's no transportation issues, there's no handling on site, and there's no exposure, and it's cost effective.
So what have been the challenges that you've had to overcome to develop the process and the technology?
Great question. Numerous. Firstly, it's actually quite challenging to introduce new and disruptive technology into the mining industry. The buzzword in every industry at the moment is innovation, and everyone has to innovate. And it's spoken about, I think, quite flippantly, that there's a tremendous amount that needs to go into innovation to make it transfer it from an idea or a concept written on the back of a napkin through to a product that actually works and works effectively. And we're still going through the pilot plant stage, so we're working very hard to make this work as well as we know it can. But really the main issues have been funding. The concept that we have for manufacturing cyanide at a mine site is not a new concept. It's been thought about for many years, and when we first started engaging with the gold mining industry to see what the level of interest was, it was tremendous. And we've subsequently found out that quite a few groups over the last 20 years have either tried to figure out how to do it themselves or have been searching for companies around the world that have actually already done this. So the concept itself, it's already sold. So selling the concept wasn't an issue. Finding the capital has been a real challenge, and the appropriate amount of capital to do it in a timely manner. They've been the main issues. I mean, the concept for how we do this was originally thought about in the early 1990s. And then I met with Jeff Duckworth, the inventor, for want of a better term, in the mid-2000s, and then we formed the company in 2007. And it's just been a steady process of stepping through the commercialization process. Since that time, desktop test work, pilot plant test work in a fume-covered laboratory environment here in Brisbane, and then now on a mine site. So we've really gone through the very structured commercialization process, and we've hit our stage gates, and that's all worked really, really well. But really the main issues that we've had has really been funding.
Helen, this last month, I believe that you went up to a tea site to talk to a group up there who has some pretty innovative plans for dealing with carbon emissions.
Well, actually not as innovative as you might think.
Oh?
Yes, I did indeed go up to Teesside and met up with a group called the Teesside Collective. I had a horrible drive through the snow. But anyway, once I got there, it was all worth it. I went to a really interesting little meeting of the Teesside Collective, an industrial CCS setup. A collaboration of lots of companies. There's four main companies that will host the anchor projects. So that's BOC, the big gas company, Lotta Chemical, which makes polyethylene, Growhow, which, as you might imagine, makes fertilizer and ammonia and such like, and SSI, which owns the huge, great big steelworks. So there's a few did you knows, which I thought might be interesting first of all. Firstly, did you know that Teesside holds 58% of the UK's chemical industry?
I did not.
That North East England process industries as a whole contribute £26 billion, that's $39 billion, to the UK economy. Teesside produces 50% of the UK's hydrogen and enough PET to make 15 billion drinks bottles per year. That's a lot of Coke.
That really is.
And Pepsi and Panda Pops and other varieties of Coke are available.
Do Panda Pops still exist?
I assume so. Teesside also is home to five of the UK's top 25 CO2 emitting plants and is responsible, it's a tiny place, responsible for 5.6% of the UK's industrial emissions. So it's pretty emission heavy. Oh yeah. But the industry there is pretty keen to do something about this. So they set up a group a few years ago now, the Teesside Low Carbon Project, to try and set up CCS, industrial CCS in the region. But it didn't get shortlisted for UK government funding and it all sort of fell apart. But the companies involved were like, hang on a second, we actually need CCS. We can't just stop there because this is something we need. So they set up the Teesside Collective, which was launched in January to start again and get this all on the ground. So the plan is that these four anchor projects, which are all quite carbon heavy, collect all their CO2, stick it in a joint shared pipe, pump it under the North Sea into one of two different storage sites, which is pretty good. A few of them collect their carbon dioxide already as part of their just general processes. Some of them will have to set up things, but they've all got a plan of how they're going to do it. So it's just a case now of trying to get funding and work out how they're going to do it. Yeah, the Teesside Collective thinks that the project is going to cut CO2 emissions in the region by 3 to 5 million tonnes per year. That's a lot of carbon dioxide that's just not going into the atmosphere, which has got to be a good thing. So I suppose the big question is, why would they want to? Well, there's lots of reasons. Obviously, the main one is, it's an environmental concern. We do need to lower our emissions.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite important. I mean, the UN itself believes that CCS could account for a fifth of carbon cuts by 2030. So the sooner we get on board with this, the better. But also in the EU, companies that emit carbon have to buy carbon permits. Now, while these are pretty cheap at the moment, they're getting more and more expensive, and the price of them is expected to quadruple by 2030. So this is something that we really need to address. So if emitting carbon gets very expensive, producing anything in the UK, in Teesside specifically, is going to get really expensive, uncompetitive, and all the companies are going to pull out, which is bad for the UK, it's bad for the industry, it's just bad. There's an environmental concern, there's a commercial concern, but surprisingly, there's also consumer concern. I was speaking to one of the blokes from Lotte, a guy called John Baker, and he was saying that actually the customers are asking for low carbon projects, but the customers are asking for low carbon products. So if they can Lotte make the plastics drink bottles, so if they can decarbonize their drinks bottles, then the customers will be happy. You know, they've got companies like Coca-Cola, Pepsi, Britvic, Innocent, they all want low carbon bottles. So yeah, it's improving their sustainability and making them more marketable.
The UK's University of Bradford has recently completed a bid to make its chemical engineering labs much, much greener. We spoke to one of the project's leaders, Professor Iqbal Mujtaba, about the challenges and successes that the Bradford team has encountered. So, from what I understand, yourself and your colleagues have just finished a project to make Bradford's chemical engineering labs more environmentally friendly. I guess the first question I have is why? Why is this an important thing to do?
Well, it actually came through STEM higher education funding. We're requested to carry out a technical audit of the lab. So actually, it was initiated, to be honest with you, that initiated by STEM higher education funding. So we thought we'll look into it. And when we actually done the technical audit, we were very surprised that for years we have been ignoring our small labs, and we did not realize that there are scopes for energy saving, water savings, and minimization of noise pollution.
Right. So how did you go about making the labs more environmentally friendly?
Well, as you will note, that we first carried out the technical audit, and then we identified the opportunities, and we came up with the suggestions that what needs to be done in terms of adding accessories to the existing processes so that water can be recycled and water consumption can be minimized, and also the energy consumption can be minimized as well by using different sort of air pumps, different equipment.
Where could you make the biggest improvements? How did you find?
I mean, in terms of water consumption, the two units which we have seen that consuming quite a lot of water, the one is the desalination. It takes about 2,400 liter for each run of the batch desalination. So certainly that water can be reused, and only we can add the makeup water to make the water saline again and to restart or redo the experiment. And the other area is sedimentation tank. Again, we currently we are throwing away all the water after mixing some powders into it to look into the characteristics of the tank. This water actually we can recycle quite a bit after settling down of the solid particles, which we are not doing currently.
How much of a difference did this project have on the overall environmental performance of your labs?
Well, in terms of noise pollution, it is quite big when you run the desalination plant. I mean, the highest we have got about 85 dB, so it's quite a bit of, I mean, when the absorption and desalination kit run, I mean, it's very difficult to hear conversation by the students or by the tutors. We believe it's quite big. And in terms of water, again, we are using fresh water and mixing salt in the desalination experiment, and there's a huge amount of water. I mean, 2,400 liter. You can imagine it's quite huge, which at the moment goes down the drain. So, I mean, if you look at the life cycle, the cost of producing fresh water is quite high. I mean, maybe in the UK we have got a lot of river water, so maybe the cost of making a meter cube of water is not that high. But if you think about the Gulf countries, where they depend on the desalination process and which are mostly multi-stage flash, and they are very energy intensive process, so the producing a meter cube of water is much higher than a liter of oil, for example, the petrol or diesel. So if you think about around the globe, the chemical engineering departments or even the university labs in those countries, the amount of savings in water would be huge in terms of energy cost.
On a cold, damp Tuesday morning in early February, I took a trip to what must be one of the weirdest working days of my life at the Frank Morton Sports Day. For those of you who don't know, the Frank Morton Sports Day is an annual event where all of the chemical engineering students in the UK travel across the country and take part in a long day of sports, you know, ranging from a football to tennis to a relay races and things like that.
And Quidditch, don't forget the Quidditch.
And Quidditch.
Crazy golf.
And they usually get rather drunk, and there's a job fair, and they network, and there's thousands of them, and it's all very strange. It's a wonderful thing, though, but it's very, very strange.
It is extremely strange. I went a few years ago to cover for TCE, and just the costumes that you see people walking around in. I remember seeing people walking around dressed as like a whole zoo full of animals. There was cows and giraffes and zebras and orangutans, and a lion, I think, was wandering around when I went. And of course, there's all the T-shirts.
Yes, thousands of T-shirts with wonderful, wonderful terrible puns on the one from Cambridge this year. I actually have just realised I can't explain because it does involve a naughty word, but it was very, very nerdy as well.
Are there any we can describe?
Most of them are pretty rude.
They're all puns.
So most of them I've forgotten because it was, as I said, it was a very, very long day. But yeah, no, it was. It's one of those things that. It's almost entirely run by the students themselves. They elect a committee, or rather, the hosting university sort of takes charge of it, and it's all run by students. And it's got an £80,000 budget this year. It attracts
pretty good,
going on 3,000 people. They rent out the NIA, the National Indoor Arena in Birmingham, and
which is massive. I'm telling you,
there's a huge jobs gap. And no other subject that I know of does anything even remotely like Frank Morton. It's incredible. If you get the chance to go and you're a student, then my gosh, go. Even if you're not going to take part in the sports, just go and hang around, have a great time. It's really incredible.
It's great to watch as well. Yeah, obviously as an old crusty journalist, I wasn't partaking in any of the sports activities.
I ran. I was in the relay race.
Yeah, Rick's a lot younger than me.
We lost really badly.
Yes, but yeah, it's great fun to watch, great fun to support, and and of course it's a great place to get jobs and meet your employers, because some of the employers send out their own teams to compete.
Yeah, there are staff teams. There's a pretty huge jobs fair there, actually.
Yeah, it's a really useful thing.
The winner for the 2015 Frank Morton was the host city of Birmingham, which completely stomped everybody else. They got more than a double the points of every other team going. It was really impressive. In fact, yeah, there were apparently. I was speaking to the president of the committee, who is obviously a student at Birmingham, and she admitted that Birmingham does have a reputation as not being the most fair play minded of universities for this, though she insisted everything was above board. In fact they got all of the draws were done, I think, by iChemie staff being filmed to make sure there were no fixes there, so it was all very above board. But yeah, they do have a rep for trying really hard.
Yes, they also have an advantage in that they didn't have to get up at 3 a.m. to get there,
though they probably did because students.
Poor old Strathclyde, eh?
Yeah. But as I said, if you are a student and you do have the chance to go to Frank Morton, it is a once-in-a-lifetime experience. It really is.
Well, three times in a lifetime experience.
Four if you're doing a master's.
Yes.
Did you know that iChemie offers a modular human factors training programme for the process industries? Human factors in health and safety covers the top human factors issues in major hazard sites. Programmes are currently delivered in the UK and Australia. Find out more at www.ichemie.org/human factors.
Well, I think that just about wraps it up for this month. If you have any feedback, then please get in touch with us, either through our Twitter, which is at TCEtoday, on Facebook, we are The Chemical Engineer, or you can email me at richard at ichemie.org. That's ICHEME.org. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll speak to you again next month. Goodbye.
Bye.